8:01 on a Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, everybody. It's going to be hot today. Just checking the weather forecast. I think it's going to get up to about 35 today.
I'm supposed to do a golf trip up to Whistler this coming weekend, and that's when it's going to start to rain, according to the forecast. So
that's fine.
Thanks for that.
That's fine. You'll actually welcome it.
I actually don't even mind.
No, it'll be great. It'll be like a shower.
During the pandemic,
sweaty shower.
During the pandemic, I have played in all weather. Like
you played during the heat wave, which I thought was crazy.
No. But before then, before the pandemic, I was not a big kind of like winter golfer,
right,
or even fall golfer, or even early spring golfer. Like, yeah. I waited until the weather was almost perfect before I golfed. But when there was nothing to do, I was like, yeah, I'll play.
I know,
I'm used to it now.
I know that we have a lot of people that work at golf courses, greenskeepers, etc. I imagine the challenge of keeping courses not being like burnt earth brown is very difficult right now.
Not burnt out, but also not totally beat up.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the courses are getting so much play. Yeah. This hour of Halford and Brough is brought to you by Kintec Footwear and Orthotics. Do your feet hurt? Kintec can help. Talk to a fitting expert today at 11 Lower Mainland locations or online at kintec.net.
This final hour of the program, Thomas Drance, who is coming up, and What We Learns are also brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. To the phone lines we go. Our good buddy, Thomas Drance, Athletic Vancouver, here in the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. What up, Drancer?
Gentlemen, doing well. How are you?
We're good, thanks. First off, sad farewell to the Van cast as we knew it. You and J-Pat had your final voyage together. How did that go?
It went well. It was weirdly emotional. You know, when it feels weird to tell you guys this because you guys have done everything together for what, 20 years? But, you know,
we've managed to stay together.
It feels longer.
It's incredible. It's incredible that the old married vibes just emanate from you. And the old married couple, anyway. And anyway, J-Pat and I never got there. More of a fling, like, you know, anyone.
We met on Hinge. He was great, but we both knew this wasn't going to last.
Yeah, lots of our friends placed bets on how long it would last. Anyone that took the under on 2 years, congratulations, you just won. It was sad to see him go. I think it worked, especially because the VanCast was like this venue to get so nerdy, right? Just like drill down into the absolute nitty gritty of Canucks details, you know, like from two guys who were like always around, like this stuff in terms of practices and, you know, road trips and on and on. So it's bittersweet, and I'll spend the next 6-7 weeks trying to get over them.
Okay. One, best of luck with that. Two,
yeah,
it's funny.
Well,
it's funny
to him. I want to note that too. Best of luck to him moving on to North Beach.
It's funny you mentioned the sort of next step and the next phase, because for the Vancouver Canucks right now, they're in a very unique situation. They just finished this frenzy of activity. I think it was 17 free agents all told that they signed. So just a staggering amount. And now I feel like we're in that part where everyone stops, takes a deep breath, exhales, and then says, okay, what's next? So I know you and Harm wrote about this this morning. It just went up on The Athletic Vancouver about an hour ago. What are the sort of next steps in terms of how you see it playing out, and maybe a timeline or maybe a series of progressions to get to the point where we're talking about training camp?
Yeah, well, I think next steps, honestly, mostly concern the RFAs, right? Our attention now turns to, you know, and there's four key RFAs, I suppose, but really two with Pettersson and Quinn Hughes. And yet it was Dickinson who filed for arbitration on August 1st. So that one is probably the first one to get done, right? Like, at this point in the offseason, you've waited long enough. You went through the whole rigmarole of expansion and free agency with, you know, your two most important players unsigned. And at that point, like, if you're not going to have the predictability of doing the deal beforehand, right? If you're not offering the types of deals that create incentives for the player, then you sort of typically wait for pressure points later on. And for Yolevi, Pettersson, and Hughes, those pressure points come, honestly, September, like mid-September, closer to training camp. For Dickinson, however, you know, his hearing will be scheduled at some point between, I think it's the 11th of August and the 26th of August, probably in the next couple of days. And then you always expect, like, no one goes to arbitration anymore. That there'll be a settlement before that hearing, almost certainly. Like, you can bet on it. Although this is a little bit distinct, too, because it's not quite as bitter when you take a guy who's never played for your team to arbitration, right? Like, it's not like you're slamming the work he's done for you. So that may be that new dynamic or that different dynamic maybe changes things a tiny bit, makes it somewhat more likely, but only modestly. No one goes to arbitration. So the Dickinson deal, I think, is one that we'd look at getting done first. And then, you know, I think it's going to be potentially, like, buckle in, because I think it might take a while, especially for Hughes, considering his 10.2C status, right? He's a black hole free agent. And players of that ilk pretty often don't get their deals done until after training camp starts. Something we saw a few years ago here with Brock Besser. Mm-hmm. But I mean, any player of that caliber, right? Like, players of Hughes's caliber who are black hole players, you know, you think of Jaden Schwartz, you think of Torrey Krug, you think of Johnny Gaudreau. You know, it's there's no leverage there. It's so rare that those players seem to settle or get their deals done, their second contracts done, without missing at least a portion of training camp. And that's sort of something to be mindful of here, too, especially with all the moves the Canucks have made this offseason, pushing so much, you know, assets and future assets and future cap space and weapons, essentially, into being good this upcoming season. You know, you'd think that creates a different type of incentive for the club to make sure that Hughes and Pettersson are there and ready to go on day one.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and Mike and I were discussing that earlier. We wouldn't be surprised if the Quinn Hughes negotiations went further than Pettersson, because you don't have the offer sheet threat with Quinn Hughes.
Totally.
That being said, if the Canucks are really grinding, you could see the Quinn Hughes camp saying, whether cryptically or directly, like, I dare you to start the season without Quinn Hughes on your 6-game road trip after the start you had last season that pretty much buried you 10 games after the season started. I dare you to do that.
Yeah. I would suspect there's not a ton of appetite for that from the Canucks end, right? But man, the Hughes one is going to be tricky, especially with what's happened to the market for defensemen, and not just second contract defensemen, but across the board, defensemen got paid over the course of the past 2 weeks. Like, he's almost looking at a completely different dynamic now than he was, you know, even when the rosters froze for expansion. I mean, since then we've seen Heiskanen at 8.45 and, you know, Kale McCarr obviously at 9.5, and then, you know, Seth Jones at 9.5, which doesn't have a direct impact on Hughes since they're buying UFA years with that contract. But nonetheless, you know, the market is trending upward for D. Does that complicate things? Does that make it harder for the Canucks to get like a 3-time, $6 million bridge type settlement, which, you know, 3 weeks ago we would have said, well, that's, you know, a premium version of what the Bruins signed Charlie McAvoy to and what the Columbus Blue Jackets signed Zach Werenski to. Zach Werenski is another one who signed a massive, massive deal, right? Mm-hmm. And now I think we'd sort of look at 6 times 3 and just think that's completely out of whack with what the players Hughes probably views as his peers, especially Heiskanen and McCarr, got. And, you know, that, I mean, it's harder to see something, even if it's a square deal relative to your comps. Like, it's hard to see that as a square deal if the players you consider yourself, you know, every bit as good as are getting 2.5 plus extra per year for many more years than what you're signing for.
Could you see any of those guys signing an Austin Matthews type contract, which was 5 years and delivered Austin Matthews, or is going to deliver Austin Matthews to unrestricted free agency pretty quickly?
So, yeah, they bought one UFA year with Austin Matthews' second contract, a big, big cap hit. You know, the equivalent for Hughes would be a 6-year deal, right? The equivalent for Hughes would be a 6-year deal because he's actually 5 years from unrestricted free agency, not your standard 4.
Okay.
That's because he's the 10.2C guy, right?
What is it for Pettersson again?
Would be 4,
okay,
which is standard.
Right.
So most guys entering their entry-level contract, having, you know, accrued three seasons for free agency, guys like Pettersson, who are dynamos right off the bat. They typically expire and have 4 years till UFA, but Hughes has five. So the equivalent length of the Matthews five-year deal would be a six-year deal for Quinn Hughes. I mean, honestly, I think that might make sense, to be totally honest with you, to essentially bridge, like, it's not a bridge, it's a long-term deal. Like, 6 years is an awfully long time, right?
It's a bridge between a bridge and a long-term?
Yeah. It's not even a medium-term deal. Like, it's a long-term deal. So for Hughes, I think that would make an abundance of sense. And I wonder if that's the best approach if you're going to, and here's where I want to use the term bridge, but really I want to use, like, straddle detention, that is paying a guy fairly despite, you know, the 10.2C status and what that market looks like historically, right? And so, you know, could you get them on matching 7.5 contracts, for example? You know, Hughes goes longer than Pettersson, but, you know, you match their cap hit. They both come in slightly above OEL. And something I've been talking about a lot is that gives you sort of a benefit, as it were, in terms of negotiations with Brock Besser a year from now, who's due a $7.5 million qualifying offer, right? Like, well, we can't pay you more than that because that's what we paid Pettersson and Hughes, right? Same with Bo Horvat the next year. You can create an internal cap using these deals by going a little bit longer than Hughes so that it matches roughly whatever cap hit Pettersson comes in at. I do think they have the space to do that. I was sort of modeling it out yesterday. Like, I do think they have the space to go long on one. I don't think they have the space to go long on both. So maybe there's a solution there where you can go longer on Quinn, considering his uncertain status and what's happened to defensemen and on and on, and maybe match their cap hits, which again, a hobby horse of mine, something that I think makes a ton of sense, especially considering the fact that, you know, I don't think you want to go into next season with either of those two players feeling like the other got taken care of and they didn't, you know, like, I think there's a benefit to, on so many different levels, to approaching them similarly, whether that means same term or same cap hit. I think one of those two things should govern these next deals.
Drancy, you mentioned next summer and Brock Besser is going to need a new contract. Also next summer, Bo Horvat and JT Miller would be at least eligible to sign extensions.
Yeah.
How much of what the Canucks did this offseason was about keeping those guys happy and wanting to be Vancouver Canucks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a key motivation. Like, I think bouncing back from last season, you know, I just think the organization and the way they thought about it and seeing where they were at in terms of the age of their group, in terms of the way that the brand had been discussed in this marketplace, in terms of the impatience of some of their key young players, the more obvious impatience by some of the older players, guys like Edler, Schmidt, guys who departed actively, took an active role in departing. I just think it was easy to look at the Canucks' positioning prior to this offseason and say, well, all their bad money expires in a year, and, you know, maybe they should just be conservative, and yeah, maybe you're not a playoff team, but you can be if you hit a bunch of some smart bets in free agency. You know, if you sign a lot of pious suitors, like, man, anything can happen. You know, that's the nerds anyway. That's the chart
nerds.
Folks. Yeah, the chart folks making their recommendations, among whom I consider myself.
Like, look at this heat map.
Yeah,
what am I looking at?
Yeah, check out this chart. he's bad. Anyway, the fact is that it would have been easy to approach it that way, but I just don't think this team could afford kicking progress in their rebuild further down the line. Like, I just think with all that the losing that this franchise has endured over the past 6 years, then the 2020 season and that playoff run, and then finishing last in the North Division with all of the sideshow pyrotechnics that came with it, I just don't think the club was positioned to take a risk that they wouldn't bounce back next season. Like, I think they had to get moving. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. you know, and I do think among them is the patience level of the core. And you know, one last thing I want to note too here, gentlemen, is, you know, among the missed opportunities, like, people think about timing a lot in hockey in terms of the term of deals, right? But what people don't often think about is, like, strike when the iron is hot in terms of contract talks, right? And one thing the club is facing now with Pettersson and Hughes negotiations, right, is that because the club was so money conscious and so reluctant to hand out commitments throughout, you know, from the moment they left the bubble pretty much until the moment they extended the coaching staff, right? Right after the season. Although, you know, there were some indications that things were loosening up before then with Pearson and Demko. I'd say after about mid-May, right? After about mid-May when they took care of Clark and took care of Green and brought in Bradshaw and then all the business we've seen since then, you know, it was until mid-May that the Canucks started really behaving in a way that more closely matched what we expect from this team, like a big hockey market team in terms of spending and how they conduct themselves. And, you know, there is missed opportunities in not having, you know, and holding extension talks with two key players like Pettersson and Hughes coming off of like the high of the bubble, right? Like, it's easier to sell the vision to players when you're talking, whether it's long or short term, like, it's easier to sell that vision after, you know, the highs of a playoff run. Like, we're a team on the rise, be part of this, you're the face of this. Like, that's a much better pitch,
right,
than, hey, we know everything was awful last year, but we've made some exciting moves. Like, what about a bridge? Like, that's just a much, much tougher sell. And I think that's worth being aware of, because there, you know, it's just another one of those sort of legacy opportunity costs from the way that the club conducted itself in 2020.
We're speaking to Thomas Drance from the Athletic Vancouver here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Drance, a part of that piece that you guys put out this morning, it does look at the reconfigured depth charts. Now, this a little bit of minutia here, a little bit of nitty gritty, but I am curious about 17 contracts signed. There's a bunch of new faces in the door. A lot of them are tweeners. A lot of them are guys that are going to bounce back and forth between Abbotsford and Vancouver. We'll kind of break it down by the forwards and the defense. Pick one guy on each that you think is maybe flying under the radar, obviously came in on either a low-end one-way deal or a two-way deal. I'm thinking, like, up front, Phil Giuseppe seems kind of interesting. Justin Dowling, Nick Petan, who obviously has a relationship with Travis Green back from their time in Portland together. Who's one that you're looking at where you're like, that could be something, that could be intriguing?
Yeah, and I think actually the two guys that I'm most curious to see are Justin Bailey, who it felt like had earned a shot,
okay,
like a longer look right before he got hurt last season. I think if he comes into camp and looks right, that his combination of speed and size will be tempting. Like, I think that's a package that could be tempting for the Canucks. Clip that. As for William Lockwood, you know, he's the other guy that I think is a dark horse, and there's a fit there. Like, not only has Lockwood now impressed the club enormously at training camp and in the AHL, but there's something about that speed, empty the tank, assertive, super fast, you know, dig pucks off the wall, forecheck hard style that seems to fit well with the way that Green has historically liked to play. And, I mean, I think he's going to get a long look. And while the right wing depth seems to be set with Tyler Mott there, like, Tyler Mott can move to left wing, right?
Sure.
No problem there. He played that there in the playoffs, and he was a massive X factor. Brandon Sutter also can move over to right wing, right? Like, there's enough versatility among the players we expect to compose Vancouver's fourth line that, like, if a center wins the job, if a right wing wins the job, if a left wing wins the job, like, they can figure that out. Like, if any of these... Giuseppe, you know, Matthew Highmore, Justin Dowling, Nick Petan, Lockwood, Matt McEwen, Bailey, class of player, all of whom appear to me anyway to be in stiff competition for one job, one everyday job,
right?
At least in the Canucks opening lineup as camp opens. You know, I think whoever wins it will get that job, and this team does prioritize and prize training camp performance. Like, they will hold an open competition. And so, you know, it's going to be fascinating. And then the other thing to bear in mind here too is going to be things like waiver dynamics and how the club manages that. And this is another thing where the type of volume that the Canucks signed should pay dividends. Like, yeah, you might lose a player or two on waivers, but you're also a little bit insured from losing all of your depth because you're not going to have like four forwards claimed. You know, if you put five guys on waivers, like maybe you lose one, but you're still going to have way more depth than this team's had. Honestly, probably in a decade. Like this is looking like a totally different, like the floor to replace injured players is going to be way higher than anything we've seen in an awfully long time in this market this upcoming season.
On the blue line, you know, I feel like there's an opportunity there if only because of what's currently constructed as the top 6, 7, 8, however deep you want to go. The guy that I keep, you know, maybe I'm talking myself into it a little bit, but I feel like Brady Keeper could be a thing. Maybe you know a little bit more about him than I do from the Florida days, but I just feel like having read and talked to a couple different people, he's 25 and it felt like maybe the development wasn't fully there. I'd like to get your thoughts on that one.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Keeper is that he is a little bit throwback. Like he's as aggressive and physical as you'll find a defenseman in the NHL these days. And that's unique. Like he's really unique as a player with that type of physical edge. And, you know, that's going to be tempting to keep around. Like no matter, you know, that makes him a keeper. Like that makes him someone you'll want to keep, I think.
Please stop this.
You're just not going to find that anywhere else though. Right. And so, you know, there are some concerns in the industry about his foot speed. Those aren't concerns that I share. I think he's got NHL level feet. And there's some development that can still happen in terms of his puck skills. And I think that's just based on him having, you know, not the same player development resources as he was coming up. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the physical play, in terms of the defensive play, in terms of the feet, for me, he's at an NHL level. He's also on a one-way deal. I think he's going to have every shot of sticking around. And the other guy to watch there, I think, is going to be Brad Hunt, right? Brad Hunt is really good. Like, you know, I know this market's really excited about a guy like Jack Rathbone, but the last time Brad Hunt was in the American League was like 2016, and he was the AHL's leading scorer. Not for defensemen, like leading scorer, period, right? Like this is a guy who is super powered in terms of what he can accomplish at the American League level. And yeah, he's a Maple Ridge kid, and if he ends up wearing the C in Abbotsford, like that's a great story, and, you know, he'll be dominant down there. But, I mean, he's an NHL defenseman, like a credible NHL defenseman who can play either side, has played it forward. He's like a classic NHL utility guy. And he's actually pretty good, and he actually can help you drive offense. And so I do think that third lefty spot is going to be a pretty interesting competition to watch for, too, particularly, you know, once Yolevi's done. I mean, that's really a three-horse race for one or two spots on the NHL roster, and some pretty interesting waiver dynamics there, too, in terms of the fact that, you know, Yolevi would require waivers to be reassigned or loaned to Abbotsford. Jack Rathbone wouldn't. And so certainly for those two younger defensemen, you know, the next 7-8 weeks are going to be critical. Like they're going to have to be looking over their shoulder and preparing for, you know, a pretty stiff test at training camp, because in Brad Hunt, there's certainly a credible NHL level option that they'll still have to beat out here.
Drancer, you're the best, buddy. Thanks a lot for doing this today. We appreciate it. We'll do this again on Thursday.
Oh, yes. Looking forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Okay,
cheers.
Have a good one, buddy. Thomas Durant from The Athletic Vancouver here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Show just flew by today, eh? Look at it. 8:25. We're heading into the home stretch now. Just two segments left, including the world-famous What We Learn segment. That's coming up next. Get your What We Learns in. Hashtag them WWL. Tell us what you learned over the last 24 hours in sports. Text it to the Dunbar Lumber text line at 650-650, and you will get the chance to be on the radio. It's as simple as that. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 6. :31 on a Tuesday. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Final 29 minutes of the program here. We got to do some What We Learns. A reminder that What We Learns and the final hour of this program are brought to you by two fine companies. The first is the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. Now tell them about Kintec and your pedorthist.
This hour of Halford and Bruff is brought to you by Kintec Footwear and Orthotics. I went for a hike on Salt Spring Island. They've got this. It's not quite as hard as the grind, but it's called Mount Erskine.
And I
walked up that, and my orthotics definitely helped. Do your feet hurt? Kintec can help. Talk to a fitting expert today at 11 Lower Mainland locations or online at kintec.net.
Okay, did we come up with an answer? Are we going to do what we learned? Are we going to kick it over to the humanoids?
Yeah.
Okay, let's play that music.
We're going to need a few things for this class.
Boring.
An eagerness to learn. A thirst for knowledge.
So, what did we learn in the last 24 hours?
When life gives you lemons, just say, F*** the lemons and bail.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn.
Because knowledge is power.
Tell you what, why don't you do yours, then we'll kick it over to the humans.
Boys. Okay. I learned that I'm going to need a NFL depth chart, which has the information about which players have been vaccinated and which players have not, because it is very much a thing now as the NFL season draws closer. And we're going to play some audio here from Vikings head coach Mike Zimmer, who is getting very frustrated with the fact that his team is not fully vaccinated.
I am disappointed that this happened. I'm frustrated with not just my football players that won't get vaccinated. I'm frustrated with everybody. So we'll just do the best we can, and you know, it's disappointing. You can see the cases going up every single day now, and that's why, you know, for the sake of everybody's health, I think it's important. But that's, some people don't understand, I guess.
So, the NFL's vaccination rate is near 90%. There are certain teams which have dropped that. I think the Seahawks are at 99%. And what's going on right now is, how should we put it? It's convincing people to do it without a mandate.
Right.
It's a very fine line that they're drawing, because a lot of people are saying, my civil liberties, how can you make me put something in my body? To which everyone says, they're not. The NFL is a private enterprise and a private business. Mm-hmm. Here, put it this way. If they're turning people off with this push towards getting vaccinated, that's the risk that they take as a business. But the reality of it is that this isn't really unlike what a lot of the companies, Google, Walmart, Disney, they're saying, if you want to work here, you have to be vaccinated. It doesn't mean that you can't choose not to work here. Choose not to work here. It's totally fine. There's your civil liberty at work.
Well, for a football coach too, is there not in the NFL a new policy that if a team is responsible for an outbreak and a game has to be canceled, that team loses?
Most importantly, game checks rather than the win loss for the players. That's the risk. If you are at the epicenter of this and you cause a forfeit, there goes your game check. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of money for a lot of guys. Now, you know, I got a feeling that we're going to see more of the holdout guys. This is where rubber hits the road, right? It's like, okay, we get that, you know, you don't want your civil liberties infringed upon. You want to be able to have the choice of what goes into your body and whatever else.
You do have that choice.
You do. But as it's a grown-up world, there's consequences to every choice. It's great if you want to make that choice, but as an independent business, the NFL is going to exercise its freedoms to say, we don't want that. Now, the crazy thing about this is that for the longest time, there's that mantra in the NFL that, like, availability is the best attribute you can have. Like, skill is great, speed is great, strength is great, but being available is a big part of this because injuries are so prevalent. That's what next man up is all about. Like, that's the great thing about the league is, like, you go down, there's another guy who, you know what his biggest asset is right now? He's available.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Or he is, in the case of a couple of teams, including the Seahawks' first opponent of the season, Indianapolis Colts, he has played quarterback at some point in his life.
So that's another story we can tack onto this. Yeah, let's just transition to that one really quickly because Basketball Phil brought this up. This is another what we learned. Moo Cow, abruptly. So Carson Wentz, who's had a really rough go of it over the last little bit, got further examinations done on his injured foot, and I guess it was a broken bone that had floated loose within the foot that was causing him great pain. So he's going to be sidelined for a while. The possibility does exist that he'll miss the Colts season opener against the Seattle Seahawks. And that would then pave the way for Jacob Eason, the former University of Washington starting quarterback, to be the starting quarterback for the Colts.
You know what I enjoy about this? There's lots of talks about Nick Foles.
I know. Just pulling him out of mothballs. He's the third stringer right now.
Mm-hmm. In Chicago behind he's also made Dalton and Justin Fields.
And he's also made approximately $43 million in his NFL career. And won a Super Bowl.
He won a Super Bowl, yeah.
But it was the one.
He was amazing in that run, too.
He was tremendous.
He was amazing.
And it came out of nowhere because he had fallen on such hard times. Just goes to show, right time, right place. Okay, Moo Cow that. Come on, Dom. Come on, Dom. There he is. How are we graded out Josh yet?
He's not. He's been excellent.
Yeah, you've been good at this.
Really
you're so young.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're 23 years old. That's remarkable to me.
The youthful energy.
It's the youthful energy. I don't know anybody that young, aside from my son, who's 10. But you're older than he is.
He's closer to your son's age than he is to your age. That's crazy, isn't it?
That just came as
that
a realization.
That just hit you with a lightning bolt,
just
didn't it?
It's in my brain now, and I cannot get rid of it.
All right.
Let's do some what we learned.
Let's print out these submissions here. He's right on it. He's right on it. Dom would be complaining about having to put up the podcast or something. I can't do two things at once. Can you do one thing at once?
Yeah. Too confusing.
Doug from Salmon Arm, what we learned. I learned that the winner of the 100 meters was so unknown that Andre DeGrasse didn't even know his name. He called him, quote unquote, the Italian guy.
Yes. Lamont Marcel Jacobs. So I was out last night. I went for beer, as I told you. And a couple of my paisans, also known as my Italian buddies, were telling me about the story here. So I guess his dad was in the armed forces at some level. I don't know where his
Were they exaggerating the whole story, too?
No. It was just because if you hear Jacobs talk, he is like a full-blooded Italian, like to the point where his English is broken.
Right?
So I'm like, well, what's the story here? So I guess his dad was at some level of the armed forces and then got restationed to Korea after meeting the mom who was Italian. They were stationed in Italy, of course. And then the mom went back with Jacobs at a very young age, like months old. And he grew up Italian. So, yeah, the interview, he played me the interview afterwards. And I'm like, oh, yeah, like he's not an American guy that got his Italian paperwork like the other day.
Right.
He is a full-blooded.
Scusi, babbity boopy.
That was him. That was after winning the gold.
So this one confused me a little bit.
Really well-timed dropped, by the way.
Yeah,
that
was
really good.
Yeah. He's excellent, isn't he?
Yes, he's very good. Okay, what confused you?
Brad and Pitt Meadows. So this was, again, I was away for the weekend, kind of on my phone, but not really. And I saw a bit of this and I didn't fully understand it. Maybe someone can help out. Brad and Pitt Meadows text in, what we learned. You can just decide to share a gold medal, which is awesome.
Oh, the high jump.
The high jump.
Yeah, I got the story here. What do you want to know?
Okay, so how? Why don't they just keep jumping until someone misses?
So it's actually in the rules, oddly enough. This isn't just something that they decided on the spot. I don't know the names off the top of my head. I do know it was a Qatari high jumper and an Italian high jumper. And what happened was they had cleared the same height, so they were on their own plane in terms of clearance.
Right.
There was a third guy, but he had more misses. But the important thing was that they had the equal amount of misses. And I think it was 2.39. Like
both of them ended with jumps of 2.37 meters and had no failed attempts until they attempted to clear 2.39.
And it was dragging on and on and
After three failures each at that height, an Olympic official first offered them a jump off to decide the winner. And then they said, can we have two golds? And then the official nodded.
Because in the rule book, it actually states that if a jump off is proposed and both participants opt not to continue, this is the option available to them, that they split gold. So I saw a lot of people pushing back on this.
Yeah, and it's of course.
Like, this isn't the Olympic spirit. You go for the win. And I'm like, if it's in the rules, if it's in the
but
actual...
should it be in the rules? Should it be in the rules?
Well, yeah.
Why is it in the rules?
Because for this exact reason is you don't want a 90-minute to 2-hour jump off. in which guys are just trying, because you get tired over the more
fatigue,
attempts that you
I
have.
Guess would
and you can't really drop the bar back because they already cleared 237. So, I mean, it was a...
What about 238?
Right.
Do they have that?
You guys got in the tank for 238?
What about they should have a 100-meter race?
Or a long jump.
Yeah,
just completely change the game on
a dunk competition. Yeah. I bet they can both dunk.
Probably.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I didn't.
No,
get...
it was cool. Look, I listen.
Well, some people got bent out of shape.
Of course they did. But you have to remember, don't worry about it. It's only the high jump.
Yeah, here's the thing.
It's not going to change your life. Yeah.
Calm down, Greg. It's soccer. Like, it's all right, okay? It's just the high jump.
Matt Nabby, what we learned, I learned that even with the yips, Simone Biles is still a medal winner. Yeah, she won the bronze in the balance beam.
Yes.
I wonder if that was the least amount of twisties, like the balance beam.
Oh, I didn't even think about it like that. Probably. Probably had something to do with it.
It must.
Mm-hmm.
How many times was she flipping? Do you know what I mean? Like, how many times was she...
The twisties is when you
airborne. This is good gymnastics analysis.
Halford and Brown,
how many times was she flipping?
More gymnastics than you can handle. I would assume that the real issue with the twisties is that when you're in the air, it's the fear of not knowing where you're going to land because you don't know if you're doing the proper rotation.
You don't know where you are.
So on the beam, maybe that's lessened. That seems to make sense to me in my vast knowledge of gymnastics.
Yeah, because you're not – I mean, I guess the dismount could be potentially problematic. But, yeah, she won another medal. Add it to the pile. And frankly, her story is way more compelling now than it would have been if she had just gone to the Olympics and, you know, swept the field and been really good. We would have been, and I read an article about this. I think it was in the Globe and Mail by Cathal Kelly. He was saying that, yeah, it would have been interesting. And then we would have forgotten about it 2 days later because it was like, oh, yeah, Simone Biles, she's still good at gymnastics.
Yep.
This
still
story, this development makes it way more compelling. For example, what do you think she's going to do? Is she going to retire? Has she said anything? She's really old for gymnastics. What is she, 24 or something along those lines?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't – is this going to make her want to come back for another Olympics or keep competing? Or does she say, you know, I've had enough. I've accomplished enough. I'm going to go do something else now.
We had this question last week, but I wanted to revisit it in the wake of what happened on the weekend. Where would you guys rank these three golf tournaments in terms of which one you'd rather win? The Masters, the U.S. Open, and the Olympics. So I caught some of the Olympic golf over the weekend. It's interesting because it really gave an opportunity for guys I'd never heard of before, practically. But
that might not say a lot because you probably haven't heard a lot of the guys on the European tour or whatever.
No, I know, but that's the thing. But that's when these guys I've never heard of on the European tour win like the Barnes & Noble Open or whatever it is. Like,
Barnes & Noble Open.
I'm like, well, that's great. They
win a book.
Yeah. The Olympics is such a interesting one for golf because it takes it out of the almost takes it out of the golf world and puts it into the realm of, well, you're representing your country. Which is a big thing, right? Because the only time you really ever get that in golf is the Ryder Cup.
It's
so
weird,
there's that nationalistic pride on the line.
It's weird, though, because I don't think it's fully caught on with the players, with the top players. I don't think it's quite there. A lot of the – I always bring this back to what you dreamed about as a kid growing up wanting to win. For golfers, it's not an Olympic medal because it's only been in the Olympics for a little while.
Yeah.
It is for the Americans, it's going to be the Masters or the US Open. And for the Europeans, it's probably going to be the Open. And I mean, the British Open. Of those three tournaments, I'd want to be a Masters winner and then a US Open and then the Olympics. For me, personally.
Well, that's fair. Rory Sabatini
for Slovakia?
Yeah, when did that happen? I'm watching. His wife is the president of the Slovak Golf Association, is it, or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's weird, though. I think that's weird. When you don't have a lot of connection to
There's no more Italian-sounding guy on the tour than Rory Sabatini, except from Constantino Rocca, I guess, who doesn't play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And Rory Sabatini, well, he's South African.
No, I know, but that's the thing. I did the research on it. I'm like, man, I can't believe he did Italy like that. Then I'm like, wait a minute. He's not even Italian. It's all over the place.
I like this one. What we learned, Tucker Poolman's contract might negatively affect Hughes's contract in regards to market price for defensemen. I don't think so. I don't think they're going to be using the Tucker Poolman.
No.
A comparison with Quinn Hughes, but it would be funny if Quinn Hughes was like, look at what the commitment you gave to this guy. Surely you got to give me, you know, five times what you gave Tucker Poolman.
I am going to be very curious to see how this plays out because unquestionably, Drantz-Barre, like things have changed over the summer, right? I know the Zach Werenski deal is different because it's his third contract, but still, all these guys coming in at 8.5 or above or $9 million,
mm-hmm.
like there is something about like the $9 million defenseman right now. I know they don't have the finances to do with Hughes, but
and for sure you can say things like, well, how many UFA years were bought, et cetera, but the players don't often think that far. No, they're just like, here's my how much am I making per year? What's my total contract? One final segment to go. I want to read one more what we learned before we go to break. Jamie, the Squamish contractor, what I learned after listening to you guys go on about how toxic social media is, that my choice of staying off all platforms of social media is one of the smartest things I've ever done in my entire life. The world was a better place before the internet. You mean when radio ruled? Ah, yes. I don't know. I never saw the glory years of the radio or the newspaper business. I am not smart at timing my jobs. It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
.852 on a Tuesday. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. So programming notes. Tomorrow, Chris Johnson, our NHL insider from Sportsnet, is going to join us. We'll go around the NHL with him. Maybe we'll get some more news on this Evander Kane story, which seems to be constantly developing.
I think the Evander Kane story might be the hot button story right now. It's been reported in the wake of the allegations against Evander Kane that multiple Sharks players have pretty much had enough of Evander Kane being on his team and would prefer that he just does not return. Now, it will be interesting to watch if the NHL deems that Evander Kane has wrongly gambled on hockey games or even Sharks games,
mm-hmm.
you could probably void his contract.
Yeah, I read it earlier, but I'll reiterate it. Steven Wino, who covers the NHL for the Associated Press, had it in his story that it's collectively bargained between the NHL and NHLPA that anyone that bets on games, and it's irregardless of betting on your own team or betting on someone else's team or betting on your team to win or lose. Like if you bet on an NHL game while an active player in the National Hockey League,
mm-hmm.
They do have the right to expel you from the league or suspend you. And that comes, I think, almost unilaterally from Gary Bettman. Like he is the ruler on this whole thing.
Well, and rightly so, don't you think?
It's one of those things that for the longest time has been sacrosanct.
Yeah.
There's certain things that you just can't do.
This goes back to Pete Rose and well before that.
Yep.
I believe the White Sox had a bit of a scandal.
They did, Jason.
Yeah.
We weren't around at that time.
How would you throw a game as a winger, though?
Well, see, that's going to be the tough part to prove.
Yeah, I wasn't getting in on the forecheck.
Right. I just stopped trying. Like, because here's the thing. If you look at his numbers, you'd say, well, he actually maybe was betting on himself. He had a really good year last year.
Shoeless Joe had good numbers, too.
I know. That's why I think. But here's the thing. In the grand scheme of it, it doesn't really matter if he, quote-unquote, threw games or not. Because the NHL's rule is pretty cut and dry. If you bet on hockey, it doesn't matter what the
machination is.
You know?
If it gets all the way to the point where they're debating whether or not he actually threw the games, well, he's probably betting on hockey then.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I would imagine that his career in a Sharks uniform would be over.
Could you imagine? You know how you can bet on player props? That would be interesting. Like if you're like, I'm feeling it tonight, and then you wager it on yourself to score a goal. Because you can bet on all that sorts of stuff.
You'd have to have a lot of action on one prop.
Yeah.
There's a lot of action on this one prop from a bettor in Northern California.
Don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to think this out in real time.
No,
right?
I know.
Like that's, I guess if you really wanted to boil it down to what could you ultimately control in a game, I guess that would be it. But I mean, it's bizarre at times to think that one player, especially in hockey, the ultimate team sport, as everyone always says.
You could do it as a goalie very easily.
For sure. For sure you could, yeah, now that I think about it. That's a weird conversation to have.
Our poll question, are the Canucks the most improved team in Canada? 71% of you on Twitter say yes, they are. I guess, is it a high bar, though, right now? I've been pretty unimpressed with a lot of the improvements that the other Canadian teams have made.
We couldn't even come to a consensus number two. So I would say the bar is low.
Right. We were like, well, maybe it's the Oilers because they add Zach Hyman, but they also lost Adam Larson.
Right. And then it was like, maybe it's Calgary, but they lost Mark Giordano.
Right. Yeah, it's not them.
No. Okay, we got to get out of here. We will be back tomorrow. Thank you all for listening on a Tuesday. Signing off, I have been Mike Halford. He has been Jason Brough. This has been the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.